The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of the New Yorker and WNYC Studios.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Salman Rushdie is one of the most revered novelists working today. He's still best known for The Satanic Verses, the novel that earned him a death sentence from the Ayatollah Khomeini 30 years ago, the infamous fatwa. The attempts on Rushdie's life that followed only seemed to have heightened his resolve to go on writing. In a 2012 essay in The New Yorker, he wrote, "Art is not entertainment. At its very best, it's a revolution." His new book is called Kishat. It's funny, it's fantastical, and it's even a little bit apocalyptic. The name Kishat starts with a Q, like Quixote. And like Cervantes' Don Quixote, published more than 400 years ago, it's the story of a kind of quest. Salman Rushdie sat down with The New Yorker's fiction editor, Deborah Treisman.
Hi, Salman.
Hi. Nice to be here, Deborah.
So your novel, which is about to come out, Kishat, draws, among other things, on the story of Don Quixote. What made you want to go back and reimagine that story?
Well, it was just a happy accident, really. I mean, what happened is about 4.5 years ago, something like that, I read Don Quixote again for the first time since I was 20, mm-hmm. You know. And the thing that had happened in the interim was that the translation was much better now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was this brilliant Edith Grossman translation. So I really enjoyed the return to the book. And almost immediately, my character kind of popped into my head, who obviously has in common with Don Quixote himself that they're both silly old fools. My Quixote invents for himself or conjures into being for himself a son whom he calls Sancho.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that, which obviously I owe to Cervantes. But what then happened is that my character really wanted to go in another direction, you know. So the book isn't structured on Cervantes's book. It was a way of setting off on a journey. And initially, I thought that's what the book would be. I thought it would be this journey novel, you know, about this old gent and his young sidekick son setting off across America on a sort of quest for impossible love,
mm-hmm.
You know. And then this other thing happened completely unexpectedly, which is that I found myself writing about the person who was writing him.
Right.
Not me.
The author.
The imaginary author.
Yeah.
And for a while, I was very undecided about that. You know, I've never really written about writing before. I've never done that thing about here is a writer writing a book.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I wasn't sure that it should stay
mm-hmm.
in the book. And I sort of gave myself permission to go down that road a bit, but then if I didn't like it, to take it out again.
Right.
And go back to the simpler structure of just Quixote and his journey. But then what happened is that these two stories began to talk to each other in ways that I found interesting. You know, they began to echo and mirror and differ from each other in ways that I thought were valuable, you know. And so then I found myself telling two stories.
Yeah.
And in a way that I suppose I should not divulge, at the very end of the book, there's a way in which they become the same story.
Mm-hmm. In the course of Quixote's journey, it is also a journey novel. It is kind of a road novel.
Yes.
Across the country. And I was wondering, when reading it, whether you actually made this drive, whether you sort of...
No. I mean, I thought about it. I thought about it. I thought that maybe I should just get in a Chevy Cruze.
Yeah. Stay at these campgrounds and visit these towns.
Stay at these various Days Inns and Motel Sixes and so on across America.
Yeah.
I didn't do it. But, you know, I mean, I've been knocking around America for close to 20 years now, you know, and I have been to most of the places in the book, or places very like them, you know, because one or two of the places are made up. You know, there is no town in New Jersey called Beringer, where people turn into mastodons.
Right. Some of what Quichotte encounters on his journey is very real. You know, he comes across the heart of racist America and various forms of bigotry along the way. And he also comes across mastodons. And there's also an Italian-speaking Jiminy Cricket.
Yes.
So how do those things come together in one story for you?
with difficulty. I sort of wanted the book to be many kinds of book at the same time, if I could make it work. And I think actually the model of the picaresque novel, of the episodic novel, allows you to do that. Because, you know, if your characters are traveling from place to place to place, they can have very different kinds of adventure in different places, and those stories can be told in different ways, mm-hmm. you know. And so it was a way for the novel to be metamorphic, you know, to be constantly changing the kind of novel that it is. So there's a bit where it's a spy novel, you know. There's a bit where it's a, like, absurdist parable, you know. There's a bit where it's a science fiction novel. And there are bits, I think, which to me are some of the more important bits, which are completely realistic stories of human beings trying to mend fences, brothers and sisters with estranged relationships, trying to fix it, succeeding or failing. And I think those human sections, you know, to me are actually the heart of the book. There's all this playfulness all around them.
Yeah, yeah. Do you worry about keeping a consistent tone when you're moving through these different landscapes?
Well, you have to know what it is that holds the book together. And what I think that is that Quichotte is going not only on a physical journey, he's also going on a kind of what you might call a spiritual journey. He's trying to be a better person. He's trying to be worthy of the hand of this impossible love, this talk show queen that he's fallen for. So he's on a quest for self-improvement, if you like, for becoming a better human being. And so is his author. You know, his author is aware of the fact that he's made mistakes in his life, that he's hurt people who are close to him and et cetera, and he wants to make things better. So he also is, in a way, engaged on a similar project, you know. And that's the line that I think goes through the book and that holds it in, and that makes it one book.
And Quichotte's through line is that he wants to get to an end where he wins this impossible love, and he's fallen in love with a TV talk show host who doesn't know him mm-hmm. at all, and in fact is a little afraid
yeah,
of the idea that he's coming for her.
thinks of him as you would, as a stalker.
And for Quichotte, it is sort of a journey into virtue, to become virtuous yes. enough to win the hand of this woman. And in fact, where it takes him is into a real moral morass.
Mm-hmm. He's very invested in the idea of the good. You know, and he wants to be a good person. And then he's offered this terrible choice, which is that in order to gain access to his beloved, mm-hmm. he has to do something bad.
Yeah.
You know, and then he has to face a choice within himself. You know, and that choice is only has weight if you know that he's somebody for whom the idea of goodness is very important.
Yeah.
And which he also invests that idea of goodness in the beloved. You know, he believes her to be good. And then he discovers that maybe she's not quite as saintly as he thought.
Well, which brings us to the other theme of Quichotte's story, which is the opioid crisis in America, which he is unwittingly tangled up in. And I wonder what made you want to write about that?
Well, two things, really. One came out of research and one came out of personal experience. The research part of it was that I'd have a general interest in what Indian Americans are getting up to.
Mm-hmm.
So I just try and keep an eye open for interesting stories in that part of the field.
Mm-hmm.
And I came across the story of an Indian American gentleman in the pharma business who was, well, I mean, now he's in jail, so I think we could call him a crook.
Yep.
who was involved in the improper sale of opioids in a way not dissimilar to the character in the book. And then it just offered me, like a kind of light bulb moment, it offered me a narrative way of getting Quichotte together with his beloved, if she herself had an opioid habit and was looking for the drugs.
Right.
So it actually helped us in a way, in a story way, it was helpful. And then there's a kind of sadder personal thing, which is that my youngest sister, she died from what seems pretty clear was an opioid overdose. You know, which none of us, I think, had understood the depth of her addiction to these things. But obviously that's remained, I mean, it's now over 10 years ago, but it's something that, for obvious reasons, has really stayed with me. And it actually also probably led me towards writing a book about brothers and sisters, you know, and about brothers and sisters who have drifted apart from each other and who don't know each other anymore, really. And there's a history of some trouble between them, but they want to mend things. I think that in some way also originated in this sort of bit of personal sadness.
Yeah. I mean, the opioid situation in this country is so enormous and overwhelming. Did you worry that sort of theme or that plot twist would overwhelm the story of the novel?
Well, I mean, I think it's important in the book, you know. I mean, I think it's fair enough if people find it important in the book. It's one of the major narrative lines, but it is only one of them.
Yeah. You know?
No, I don't think it overwhelms, but I think it's dealt with seriously. You know, I think if you're going to take on a subject like that, then you have to do it right. You know, you have to know what you're talking about and you have to give it proper weight.
Yeah. This novel does deal with opioids. It deals with other topical things, black sites. It deals with sort of cyber warfare. It deals with so many things that are happening culturally now. And I wonder, do you feel any sort of obligation or urge as a novelist to address things that are culturally and sociologically important or politically important?
Well, I wanted it to be a contemporary novel. I wanted it to be a novel about what's going on, you know, and I wanted Quichotte to journey not just through little towns in the Midwest, so on, but to sort of journey through the reality of our time. And not Quichotte himself as a character, but Quichotte as a book should be about what's going on. You know, I've always really liked the risky thing of writing very close up against the present moment. If you do it wrong, then it's a catastrophe. If you do it right, then you with luck, you somehow capture a moment, you know, and people in the future, if there is a future in which people read books, can read it and be taken back into the moment, you know. And so it has the dual pleasure for contemporary readers of kind of recognition. That's how things are. And for future readers of discovery of, oh, that's probably how things used to be.
Well, without giving anything away, the book, in the world of the book, is racing towards apocalypse of some kind. Are we?
Well, I mean, one of the things I have to confess is that, you know, I, as a kid, was a science fiction nut. And I think a lot of science fiction got into this book. The point about end of the world novels is that they're usually not about the end of the world. You know, they're usually about some form of crisis in the world. And in this case, I think, they're also about the two characters of the two main storylines facing the end of their world. In other words, you know, coming close to the end of life. You know, and both of them contemplating that. You know, and the physical manifestations of apocalypse are in a way a metaphor for their own personal apocalypse, which all of us face, you know. And also, I think, on a broader, less personal level, the idea that we might be at the end of a particular world, the world essentially in which I have spent my life, you know, and you too, you know, and most of us have spent our lives in a particular world that appears to be vanishing. You know, it appears to be transforming so much that it can't be said to be the world that previously existed. You know, and that idea of the end of a world, you know, not the end of the world, you know, is something that was certainly in my mind.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think it's any part of the writer's duty to provide hope. but I do think that in some way, in the optimism and hopefulness of the character of Quichotte, you know, there is that, you know. I mean, he against all the odds, he has no reason for optimism, and yet he feels it. Mm-hmm. You know?
And he makes things happen.
And I felt that gave the book a kind of a quality of hopefulness, even though he is surrounded by things that ought to militate against that.
Yeah.
Salman Rushdie talking with fiction editor Deborah Treisman. More of their conversation in just a minute. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to the Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Last week, novelist Salman Rushdie sat down with The New Yorker's Deborah Treisman to discuss his new book, Quichotte. The book is a kind of prismatic portrait of contemporary America. And at its center is a man who, like many of us, is obsessed with television, but maybe even a little more than most. Here's Rushdie reading from the very beginning of Quichotte.
There once lived at a series of temporary addresses across the United States of America, a traveling man of Indian origin, advancing years, and retreating mental powers, who had developed an unwholesome because entirely one-sided passion for a certain television personality, the beautiful, witty, and adored talk show host Miss Salma R., whom he had never met, an infatuation that he characterized quite inaccurately as love. In the name of this so-called love, he christened himself Quichotte for the opera Don Quichotte, and resolved to be his beloved's knight-errant, to pursue her zealously right through the television screen into whatever exalted high-definition reality she and her kind inhabited, and by deeds as well as by grace, to win her heart.
Quichotte's journey to find Miss Salma R. is a journey across the landscape of our America. He confronts racism, the lingering effects of the war on terror, and the loneliness and isolation that can come from life in the social media age.
The truth was that Quichotte had almost no friends anymore. No social group, no cohort, no posse, no real pals, having long ago abandoned the social world. On his Facebook page, he had friended, or been friended by, a small and dwindling group of commercial travelers like himself, as well as by an assortment of lonely hearts, braggarts, exhibitionists, and salacious ladies behaving as erotically as the social medium's somewhat puritanical rules allowed. Every single one of these quote-unquote friends saw his plan when he had enthusiastically posted it for what it was, a harebrained scheme verging on lunacy, and attempted to dissuade him for his own good from stalking or harassing Miss Salma R. In response to his post, there were frown emojis and bitmojis wagging fingers at him reprovingly, and there were GIFs of Salma R. herself crossing her eyes, sticking out her tongue and rotating a finger by her right temple, all of which added up to the universally recognized set of gestures meaning cray-cray. However, Quichotte would not be deterred.
Rushdie's book also has some fantastical elements, which he attributes in part to his early reading habits. Here's Salman Rushdie with The New Yorker's fiction editor, Deborah Treisman.
Were you always a science fiction reader?
I was for a bit. When I was a teenager at boarding school in England, I spent a lot of my spare time reading sci-fi. To put it simply, there's sort of literary and hardcore. So, I mean, of course, I loved the literary, the kind of Ray Bradbury, Kurt Vonnegut, Arthur Clarke, Philip K. Dick, Ursula Le Guin kind of science fiction. But I also really liked the really, you know, nuts and bolts hardcore thing in magazines with wonderful names. Like there was a magazine called Galaxy. There was a magazine called Astounding. There was another magazine called Amazing. With typography, you can imagine, you know. And there you had the real techno writers, you know, not so much the fantasy writers as the kind of the real science fiction, you know, where science was the point, mm-hmm. you know. Frederick Pohl and C.M. Kornbluth, you know, James Blish. You have to be the real aficionado to get to these people. And I mean, I retained some of it. And in particular, these two stories that I made some reference to during writing Quichotte. One is Catherine MacLean's Pictures Don't Lie, and the other is Arthur C. Clarke's story, The 9 Billion Names of God, a bizarre early computer story about Tibetan monks who buy a computer to count the 9 billion names of God, at which point they say the purpose of the universe will have been fulfilled and the universe will end. So that gave me a little clue about how to approach my end of the world story. At a certain point, I stopped reading so much science fiction, and a lot of it had to do, I mean, now it's different because now there's a lot of very good science fiction written by women and a lot of very interesting women characters in science fiction, whether it's, you know, Octavia Butler or whoever it might be. Back then, in the 60s, which is when I was doing this, it was a very male form. Women in science fiction tended to be either, you know, three-breasted Barbarella types.
Right.
Or they were white-coated lab technicians of completely no sexuality at all. And both of them seemed quite tedious to me. And I just somehow, that put me off for a while. But I retained lots of it.
Mm-hmm. And it probably helped form your imagination at that point.
I think it did. I think, you know, it has helped. I mean, you know, I've never been particularly a kitchen sink realist, have I? I mean, I've always moved in the direction of the surreal and the fabulous and so on.
And anything can happen.
And anything can happen. And I think science fiction gives you some of the equipment for how to approach that.
Yeah. You mentioned your sister's death due to opioid addiction. Were you thinking of that specifically when you were writing this story?
Well, it had a lot to do with the starting point. I mean, it was one of the, not just the opioid thing, but the problems of sibling relationships, you know, became something that I really wanted to write about. Because this is my much younger sister. The sister was 14 years younger than me. And we didn't live in the same country, and we didn't see that much of each other. And I had no idea that she was sinking into this addiction. And since then, obviously, if you lose somebody as close to you as a sister, you think about it a lot. You know? And I wanted to write about that, about how brothers and sisters, particularly in this age when we live such scattered lives, where families can be dispersed around the world, like my family, like many migrant families. And I wanted to write about what that does to family ties and how things can be strained and what people can do or can't do to try and make things better. You know, and all of that, I think, came out of the circumstances of my own family.
Yeah. I mean, the book has two pairs of brother and sister.
Two pairs, and the story between them is not the same.
No. You
know, they're both trying to do the same thing, but how it goes is not the same.
Yeah, yeah. They both involve estrangement and then attempts at reconciliation.
Yeah, and just distance. They're people who've led their lives very distant from each other, physically distant, and therefore there's other kinds of distance.
Yeah. So this is, I think, your 14th novel?
Yeah.
Has the way you go about writing a novel changed?
Yeah, it's changed quite a lot, in fact, you know, over this long period of time. I mean, the first novel was 1975, you know, so it's been a while. I used to need much more architecture. You know, I actually couldn't start until I had a very clearly mapped out structure. And even not just the big picture of the book, but actually some of the smaller aspects of the book. I really needed to have worked it out. And until I had that, the wheels wouldn't turn, really. I wasn't able to put flesh on the bones. As I've gone on, that has become less and less the case. You know, and I've become much more excited by the prospect of discovery, you know, of what simply happens on the pen, the act of writing. You know, because I do believe very strongly that the way in which your mind works in the moment of writing, in the act of creation, is a way in which it doesn't work at any other time. You know, so in the act of creation, you can make your characters think things, say things, behave in ways that you would never have imagined in real life, you know, for yourself or for people that you know. And so I've come to trust that imaginative moment, you know, and accept that you also have to be very skeptical of it. You know, you can let yourself go down a path, but you have to become very, very critical of it the moment you've done it. Is this right? Is it wrong? Is it where I want to be? Is it not where I want to be? But let it happen on the page. And an enormous amount of the things in this book are of that kind. You know, as I say, I didn't expect the author character to be there at all, you know, and he became rather a major character.
At what point did you know where you were going with the book, what the end would be?
I mean, frighteningly late, really.
Yeah.
You know, because I did know that for me, for the book to fully work, these two narrative lines had to in some way merge. You know, the writer and the written had to somehow satisfyingly unite. And I didn't know how to do it. And was quite bothered about that.
Yeah.
And then one day it just happened. I just sat there and I thought, oh, I know what. You know. And again, the thing that helped me was the memory of a very, very old science fiction story by Catherine MacLean called Pictures Don't Lie, which was also made into the kind of late night TV B-movie that Quichotte might have watched in one of his many motel rooms. So it had a natural way to enter the story. But without saying exactly what I did with the story, because I didn't use the story exactly as written, but it gave me my ending.
Yeah.
And at that point, I felt real happiness because I thought, okay, now maybe it works. It was a scary book to write this because all the way through writing it, I had to face the constant questioning, is what you're doing absurd and bizarre in a good and useful and valuable way? Or is it just absurd and bizarre for the sake of it, and nobody will care?
Well, I think you're starting to have an answer to that question.
Well, so far so good.
Well, thank you, Salman.
Thank you.
Salman Rushdie. He spoke last week with The New Yorker's fiction editor, Deborah Treisman.
Between us.
Once you hear Brittany Howard's voice, you're not likely to ever forget it. Howard is the front woman of the Grammy-winning blues rock band, the Alabama Shakes. But this year, she's striking out on her own with a solo album.
I was like, guys, you know, I think I'm going to do my own record. And at first it was met with like a lot of confusion and disappointment. But then we sat down.
Were they angry?
I'm not sure if they were angry. I think they're more like surprised. But we sat down and we talked about it for several hours. And at the end of the conversation, everybody was like, okay, we understand, we get it.
Did they in the back of their minds, or do you get the sense that they felt that was the end of the Alabama Shakes?
Probably, yeah.
Is it?
I don't know. Wherever creativity leads my ship, I can't force it. Why can I wait? Why can I
sing? Why can I wake without you always? I'll talk to Brittany Howard about her new record, Jamie. That's next week. And still ahead today, the man behind a $70 million art heist in Paris. You're listening to the New Yorker Radio Hour. Time is gonna kill it. Time is gonna kill it. Time is gonna kill it.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. In 2010, on a night in May, some $70 million worth of art was stolen from a museum in Paris in one night. For months, the French police couldn't find the thief, and they still haven't found the paintings. It seems like something from a heist movie, but this actually happened, a $70 million theft. And who pulls off something like that? And how? Here's contributor Jake Halpern with the story of the thief known as the Spider-Man of Paris.
It was the screw that gave it away. Viren Tomic was standing in the dark at night in front of a window of the MAM in Paris. That's the Museum of Modern Art. He just used his pocket knife to scrape the paint away so that he could see the screw better, examine just how it bit into the window frame. And it confirmed his hunch. The frame was old-fashioned, just like the window from a job he'd done before. He knew how to take it apart. A few days later, Tomic goes back to the MAM. The galleries are open, and like everyone else, he goes into the front door, buys a ticket, and wanders around. On the walls, there are Picassos, Kandinskys, and some motion detectors that don't seem to be working. He makes a note. The sensors, the paintings, the windows. There's an opportunity here. Tomic has been writing to me for a year from his jail cell in France. An actor is reading from the letters that he wrote to me.
I was a child with a devious tendency, an evil disposition. I did not speak much. I remember myself when I was 7 or 8 years old, and cousins I lived with. I would put cactus spines in their shoes to see how much pain they could stand. I locked a friend my age in an empty barrel. We were playing hide and seek. I abandoned him, hoping that nobody would find him.
The press calls him Spider-Man, but he says that's been his nickname since he was a kid, back when he grew up in a Bosnian mountain town, famous for its raging river and tall bridge. Local kids made a sport of climbing the rocks along the riverbank and leaping into the water.
It's a custom for us, like in Acapulco in Mexico. For me, climbing started around the age of 6 or 7.
That's where Tomic climbed to his first robbery. He used a ladder to get to the window of a library about 16 feet up a wall. He stole a few old books. When he was 11, Tomic left Bosnia-Herzegovina for Paris. His family lived in a building that shared a wall with the Père Lachaise Cemetery, where Jim Morrison, Marcel Proust, Edith Piaf, and many others are buried.
There was everything in the cemetery. Black masses at night. Hippies going to Jim Morrison's grave. Hundreds of people came on pilgrimage. There were drugs everywhere. And dealer gangs would fight each other. It was our playground because it was the only thing we had. The cemetery in front of the window.
Tomic had a hard time in Paris. A hard time learning French. And money was tight for the family. His mother was disabled and his father was mean to him, cold. Tomic often ran away from home. By 12, he started stealing things to get by. He'd break into cars and steal the stereos or rummage around in the glove box. By 14, he and some friends had started breaking into apartments.
My first burglary in Paris. I used the cemetery outer wall to access the yard and climb one of the buildings. I got a gold-plated Dupont lighter with a small bag of jewels and no more than 150 francs. So, did I imagine that I was going to become a famous burglar? Of course.
He got hooked.
It started as a test, like an obsession to do something more. Something was pulling me, encouraging me to do it. Later, I found that there was a double personality in me, a spiritual guide. My ability to sneak into buildings is like a gift. I sometimes think for a while. Then, as if by magic, without the magic wand, I have the formula.
The night after he uncovers the screw in the MAM window, Tomic goes back. He wears a hoodie, and he walks around the outside of the museum very carefully. He has to pick the right window. And there's one just behind a parapet, out of view of the security cameras.
The one on the corner of the façade that allowed me to watch over both sides of the esplanade. Nobody could see me, except for a few passing cars.
Now the museum, it's across the street from the Seine. Tomic finds an inconspicuous spot to sit, and he waits.
I stay there 5 hours to see if an internal or external security check will happen. Inside, a guard shows up around 3 o'clock in the morning. A guard with a dog comes to the street to check the surroundings. So, I am not alone. The museum is not alone.
He watches for another night, just to make sure that he's got the guard's routine down. And once he figures out his window and the schedule, Tomic goes back with supplies. He's got a dark piece of cloth that he hangs like a curtain outside the window to give himself cover.
It is smart, and it allows me to do my job quietly, without being seen.
Tomic sits and works. He uses paint-stripping acid to expose the heads of each screw. Then he applies another solution to remove the rust.
I chose acid with a stripper for the frame paint, a small Dremel tool to remove the plaster where the screws are. It is necessary to sand off and clean everything. 2 hours per night, 6 nights. There is a lot of work to be done.
And always, always, he keeps an eye on his watch. He's a pro. He's been doing this for decades. He's come to believe that his success is part practice, but also part destiny. It's like he feels mystically drawn to the places he robs.
I also have to be in harmony with certain places. Some places pull me. Something is waiting for me. Sometimes it's hard to understand what I feel. So I let myself be guided by my subconscious. The luxury apartment started when I was 17 years old.
His first one is this chic building, and he gets his way up onto the roof and then rappels down the side to the fourth floor to the apartment that he's got his eye on.
The apartment was more than 5,000 square feet. I noticed white sheets on some dressers and furniture. All the works of art were placed on the wooden floor. There were lots of them. It looked like a museum.
Tomich didn't know anything about paintings, and so it didn't occur to him to take them. But he did notice a catalog for an upcoming art auction. And a few weeks later, he went to check it out.
That's when I realized that a month before I had at my feet everything that was in front of me at the auction. There were two Renoir and several Ingres and Degas. When I realized the prices, I couldn't believe it. The famous books of Picasso and Chagall were sold for more than 800,000 francs at the time. That's how I came to like works of art, because everything that was sold was worth millions.
But here's the thing. Stealing art, it's not the same as selling art. Stolen masterpieces are like gold that happens to be radioactive. They seem valuable, but are actually dangerous and unsellable.
Jewels were the best choice. I could live off them and never be in jail. Really, I got into art personally. I like paintings the most. I had Degas, Renoir, Signac, Derain, Pissarro, Dubuffet, and many others. To sell them was dangerous, and I never had reliable sources abroad to flog them to collectors or receivers.
Tomich got caught sometimes. In fact, he spent nearly 15 years in prison. There was one guy, though, who Tomich could sell to reliably. His name was Jean-Michel Corvez, and he ran this small gallery right in the Bastille. Corvez was a middleman, so he had clients, and they had particular tastes. And those tastes were the basis of a kind of shopping list that he gave to Tomich. On this list, there was Basquiat, Chagall, Klimt, Pizarro, Monet. Oh, and Modigliani and Leger, they were on the list too. And they were also on the walls of the MAM when Tomich strolled through the museum. So after he spots these paintings, Tomich meets with Corvez. He tells him what he's seen, and Corvez says that he wants the Leger, a painting called Still Life with Candlestick. They haggled. Corvez would only pay 40,000 euros, which was less than Tomich wanted, and way less than the painting was worth. But in the end, Tomich gave in. The money was nice, of course. But for Tomich, he also just loved pulling off a clean heist. It's the early hours of May 20th. The streets are quiet. It's dark. Paris is asleep. And Tomich's window is ready. He's bought two suction cups that he attaches to the glass pane. And then he uses a crowbar to ever so gently pry the window from the frame.
There is also the seismic sound alarm on each. The slightest noise can trigger it. So I am very careful, especially when I move the window pane, which is very heavy. Behind the window pane, there is the grill, padlocked with a chain, which I have to open. It is not hard.
He slips into the museum and then leaves almost immediately. He goes back to the banks of the Seine, where he waits for 15 full minutes just to make sure no alarms have gone off in the museum. When it seems like the coast is clear, he climbs back through the window a second time. He takes the Leger off the wall and out of its frame. Now, this should be it. Mission accomplished. A clean job. But standing alone in the museum, in the dim light and the silence, a feeling overtakes him. That old irresistible pull. And he finds himself staring face to face with Matisse's pastoral of three nudes reclining in a verdant setting, while a fourth figure with dark red coloring plays lute.
It's magical. Its colors and the paint that pops out a little in relief, thick, make a beautiful work. In this painting, I saw a deep, vivid nature, much more fertile than today. And the little devil playing his flute out of nowhere, as if by magic, as if he were the guardian of this environment where hostesses, guests join in on his alluring music. I love impressionists.
He grabs it, and a Modigliani, and then three more paintings. Then he spots another. It's Modigliani's Woman with Blue Eyes.
I will never forget what this woman with blue eyes did to me. When I went to get it off the wall, it told me, "If you take me, you will regret it for the rest of your life." I think when I touched it, to take it out of its frame, it started instantly. A fear that came over me, like an iceberg. A freezing fear. All the hair of my arms was stiff. I had to run away. That was it.
So he leaves the painting on the wall. He takes the others out of their frames and carries them to his car. And he sits there for 5 minutes, equivocating. I mean, he's so close to the museum, he could go back for more. The window, it's still accessible. It would be so easy. And like that, he's in motion again, crossing the street back towards the museum that he's just robbed. He's stepping over a small barrier when his pants rip. A car stops at a red light a few hundred feet away, and boom, reality sets in. The streets are empty, and here he is, next to the museum, wearing a hooded sweatshirt, looking very much like the thief that he is. He leaves, this time for good.
The evening at MAM could have been worse. Not for me, but for them. 5 was the limit. I saw the burglary of the 5 paintings from the MAM in my dreams, 15 years earlier. I knew that someday I would do something great.
More than $70 million worth of art stolen in one night. The 5 paintings were some of the most important in the museum's collection. Investigators said that the thief had a sophisticated knowledge of the works. At least he had a good eye. The next morning, though, Tomic has a problem. Instead of one stolen painting on his hands, he has 5. When he meets the buyer, Corvez, he only gets paid for the Leger, the painting they'd agreed on, a shoebox filled with 40,000 euros in small bills. But Tomic gives all 5 paintings to Corvez. Corvez says he'll try to sell 3, no promises, but Tomic wants Matisse's Pastoral for himself. He's just leery of having it on him right now. After all, he's a convicted art thief. He's got to lay low. Sure enough, the police start watching him. As their investigation points ever towards Tomic, they begin listening in on some of his phone calls. And when they actually call his phone, they get this surreal greeting.
If you want to buy paintings or works of art or exceptional jewelry, do not hesitate to contact me. Among the lot of paintings, there are also 5 that are extremely expensive, so we can discuss.
Tomic is so eager to sell the other paintings that he's actually advertising them to people who call, and he's bragging a bit too. But the police, they need more than just an outrageous phone message to arrest Tomic. They need material evidence. About a year goes by, and Tomic needs money. But it's not just money he needs. He wants his Matisse back from Corvez. On the upside, you know, he's not in jail. And maybe even the MAM robbery will go unsolved, and he'll eventually get some money for the rest of the MAM paintings that he'd given to Corvez. But Tomic robs this other apartment, and he gets busted. This time he stole some watches and a Pizarro, and when the police search Tomic's apartment, they find the stolen jewelry, bunch of watches, climbing equipment. They also found paintings, but not the ones from the MAM. When the police questioned him, Tomic confessed to the latest apartment robbery. But then the police tell him that just a couple of days earlier, they'd questioned Jean-Michel Corvez too, and Tomic, he gets paranoid.
I could not believe it. Maybe he wanted me to go to jail, so he walks away. With people like Corvez, you will quickly rot in a very deep hole for the rest of your life.
He's totally worried that Corvez is going to pin the entire MAM job on him. Lie about the fact that it was Corvez himself who commissioned the robbery in the first place. Not just that. What if Corvez would get off and keep the paintings? Or worse yet, what if he'd already sold them without giving Tomich any money?
I had been waiting for a year, I thought. He had already sold all my works. It was a nightmare. The question is to know where the works really are right now.
Now, if Tomich confessed to his part and told them everything he knew about Corvez, maybe at least the police would find the art.
For me, the trial was the solution to make the paintings reappear. Maybe they are still alive, but well hidden.
At trial, Corvez said he'd pass them along to someone else, another middleman, who then testified that he'd panicked and thrown them into the trash. Yeah, the trash. In France, there's no penalty for lying on the stand. And Tomich doesn't believe that Corvez or the middleman told the truth. And I gotta wonder how honest Tomich was with me. He seemed to really love telling his story, but sometimes I felt like he was toying with me, just reveling in the mystery that he had in fact created. And sometimes he seems to think that whoever has the paintings will give them up.
One day or another, he will be forced to give them to the person to whom they belong. That is to say, me.
Jake Halpern is a contributor to The New Yorker, and the letters from Vieran Tomich were read for us by actor Jean Brassard. I'm David Remnick, and that's it for The New Yorker Radio Hour this week. Hope you enjoyed the show, and I hope you'll join us next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Karen Frillman, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Caroline Lester, Louis Mitchell, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Meng-Fei Chen, Emily Mann, and Keegan Zima. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.